from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For millions of Americans, a big load of student loan debt comes right along with the college diploma. It's a growing burden that a generation and more now knows too well. For some, a crushing burden. For others, just enough to hold them back, hold them down. Yesterday, the president moved on student debt. But it's a big issue. This hour, On Point, the cost of college, the burden of debt, and what to do. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Is that you, stacked with student loans, debt? What's the answer? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in a few minutes from Senator Elizabeth Warren on her push to cut interest rates on student debt. But first, to the president's executive order yesterday. Nirvi Shah joins us from Washington, deputy managing editor at Politico, former education reporter for Education Week and the Miami Herald. Nirvi Shah, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So the president's saying you'll pay no more than 10% of what on what?
So no more than 10% of your monthly income on your student loan repayments. So they're trying to close down how much you actually have to pay per month and make it easier for you to repay your loans.
Of your monthly income or your monthly discretionary income? I've heard that phrase tossed around. What's that refer to?
That's how much money you have left over at the end of the month to do with what you want. But as far as I understand, it is your monthly income overall, not just your monthly discretionary income.
I don't understand how those two really don't fit together. If we're subtracting rent and food and whatever else is there from your monthly income, those are two quite different numbers.
They are. They're very different numbers. So if it was just discretionary income, it would be a really microscopic payment. And I don't think that that is what the president's aim is with this change.
And student loans, what are they talking about there? Every kind of student loan, some kind of student loans, Nirvi?
These are federal student loans. Those are the ones that the federal government can control and have an impact on. And so that's what they're talking about. But this should carry with this particular piece of action combined with a similar change that the Obama administration made a couple of years ago. This should encompass a large amount of borrowers who do have federal student loans and have gotten them in the last, relatively recent history.
How much of the borrowing that goes on to pay for tertiary education today in this country is federal lending, federal loans?
Nowadays, the bulk of it is. Private student loans have kind of gone by the wayside to some extent just because of some reforms in the student loan industry over the last few years. And there was a real push for the Education Department, the U.S. Education Department, to be overseeing and administering these loans, which is, of course, has its own fair share of criticism for sure.
So this policy was already out there. He's using an executive order to expand it to more people, to push it further back in time, I guess.
Yes, exactly. So when they did this first in 2011, via executive order, and they somehow left out, there was a chunk of borrowers who were left out, and yesterday's action was meant to capture those borrowers who were left out of that earlier action. These are folks who took out loans before October 2007 or stopped borrowing any new money by October 2011. That chunk of borrowers, up to 5 million people, were left out previously.
So is this it, Nirvi? Nobody has to pay more than 10% of what they make? That seems not fun but manageable, so problem solved.
Well, if only it were that easy. I think the bottom line that a lot of folks who, certainly appreciate the president's action, but would say the bottom line is that college is still too expensive and there needs to be a way to rein in the cost of college so fewer students have to borrow so much money and end up in debt for, they're paying these loans off. The tail on these is 20 years. It's in some ways like a mortgage, you could think.
I've heard this described as a modest step. The president is also calling for, and this he can't do by executive order, but calling on Congress to push legislation through that's been proposed, Elizabeth Warren, among others, on board. We'll hear from her in a moment, but that would cut interest rates on existing student loans. How much?
Exactly. The exact figures remain to be seen, but there is a push that, you can refinance other types of debt, so why shouldn't you be able to refinance student loans as well? The same criticism there, though, that people say it's not getting at the heart of the problem and it will not solve people's issue. They may not really experience much of a savings over the life of their loan in real dollars that are in their pocket every month by Senator Elizabeth Warren's bill.
Who's going to pay for these programs? I mean, what's the cost to the federal government, and where does that come from?
Well, it's definitely a cost to taxpayers because these are federal loans. So the Elizabeth Warren's bill would be paid for by the so-called Buffett rule, which would raise taxes on the wealthy, which makes it unpopular among some Republicans for sure. And the president's action would be paid for by taxpayers. There would be an unknown cost. Yesterday, Education Secretary Arne Duncan said that the exact cost of the move is not yet known.
Does anything that was either signed or proposed yesterday go to the issue of cost, Nirvi? I mean, after all, if you could bring costs down, that would be even more fundamental.
No, not the action that was taken yesterday. There are other federal initiatives that are, you know, attempting to hopefully change the conversation on cost, but not the things that were taken care of this week or done this week.
Nirvi Shah at Politico, thank you very much for joining us. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
We'll go in just a few minutes to Elizabeth Warren, who's pushing for lower interest rates on some of this debt. But first, a couple of views on the president's new push. Kevin Carey is director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation. Kevin Carey in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Elizabeth Baylor is associate director of post-secondary education at the Center for American Progress. Everybody's organization sounds pro-America. Elizabeth Baylor, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Kevin, does the president's executive order yesterday solve a piece of the problem? What piece? Is it a problem in itself? If so, how so?
It does, I think, make a significant step towards solving a piece of the problem, and that's the problem of students not only graduating from college with more likely to have debt and larger amounts of debt, but over the last 5 years, graduating into a very soft job market. And so I think that the president's proposal is best understood as a kind of social insurance program, where if you happen to be born in the wrong year and graduate during a recession and it's hard to find a job, then this program protects you because not only is it confining your loan payment to 10% of your income, but if you don't have any income because you're unemployed, then you don't have to pay anything. It's also important to note, and you touched on this earlier, in addition to reducing the monthly payment, if you go into a public service job, you can have your remaining loan balance forgiven after 10 years. And if you're in any kind of job, you can have your remaining loan balance forgiven after 20 years.
No matter what you're making.
That's right.
No matter what you've paid in or paid off.
Exactly. And so, you know, one of the downsides to having a lower monthly payment is that you're not paying your loan down as fast. And so interest starts to accrue.
Mm-hmm.
So this protects people from having very large balances kind of catching up with them in the long term.
Elizabeth, are we fixing this then, or are we just putting a government backstop behind everybody and saying, you know, pay 10% at least, and in 10 or 20 years, whatever you've paid, it's done. Public picks up the tab for the rest. We're fine.
Well, I think that one of the main problems has been the increasing cost of higher education. At the state level, we've disinvested from post-secondary education, and we've transferred a lot of the revenue that institutions receive to tuition payments. And so this is a little bit a situation where students are forced to borrow more to pay off their loans, and there's significant evidence that there are a lot of borrowers who are in distress. The Center for American Progress recently conducted an analysis of the federal student loan portfolio, which is about $1 trillion of outstanding loans.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that 60% of borrowers are in repayment, are actually making their scheduled payments. But the remaining 40% of borrowers were in deferment, forbearance, or in outright default. And we think this is a worrying level of distress. As Kevin said, if you're born in a year where there's a soft economy when you graduate from college, your income might not be as high. And this program would allow, while you have low income at the beginning of your career or during a economic downturn, this program would allow you to pay lower payments, but you would be still responsible over the term to continue to pay your loan payments. And we think that it's a really great first step, and it's important to make sure that student loan borrowers are able to manage their debt properly.
We'll look more at the details of that. Kevin, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, who will join us after a break right here, wants to go further and actually cut the interest rate on a lot of student debt in this country. Good idea. She says, why should they pay more than the banks pay to borrow money?
Well, it's a very expensive idea, and I think that should be understood. The budget estimate for the president's proposal is about $7.6 billion. I think Secretary Duncan said he wasn't sure how much it was, but this is actually something that the administration has proposed previously in their budget that came out earlier this year, and there was an estimate of $7.6 billion. Senator Warren's proposal would cost more like $58 billion over 10 years, with a corresponding tax increase to make up for the revenue. The reason that the two programs are so different is that Senator Warren's proposal would lower interest rates for nearly everybody. I think the Congressional Budget Office has estimated 95% of borrowers would be eligible for this refinancing. So including people who are having no trouble paying their loans back at all, it would just simply be kind of a bit of a windfall for them. So,
does it make sense anyway to pull that monkey off the back of this generation, or are you saying it doesn't make fiscal sense?
Well, I mean, it just depends on what your priorities are, I suppose. Me personally, if I had a choice between if I could raise taxes on millionaires and transfer that money to student borrowers, I would do it. I think that's a good public policy, but not everyone agrees with that. There are limited resources available to help people afford college. And so it is an expensive and very sort of broad brush proposal that would benefit both people who are struggling and people who are not.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about student loans, student debt, and the cost of college. We're looking at the president's call for change and more. Kevin Carey is with us from the New America Foundation in Washington. Elizabeth Baylor is there as well at the Center for American Progress. With us right now from Washington, Democratic U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren. She's a member of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. Her new memoir, A Fighting Chance, out a month or two ago. Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, thanks very much for joining us. What exactly are you proposing, Madam Senator?
Well, it's a pretty simple proposal. It says that for all those people who have outstanding student loan debt, some of it's at 6%, 8%, 10%, and even higher, depending on when you took those loans out, we propose to refinance it down to the current rates for new borrowers. That's 8.6% for undergraduate loans, a little higher for graduate loans, and basically do for student loan borrowers what homeowners have all done. Refinance down in the current interest rate environment, what small business owners have done, refinance their loans down, even what states and towns have done, refinance their loans down to lower rates. And we want to offer the same thing to students.
Did you say that undergraduates, the new grads or whoever's got that debt, it would only go down to 8.6%? That
no,
still sounds pretty high.
3.86%. Did I say it wrong?
No. Maybe I just 3.86. What's your estimation of what kind of savings would that mean in aggregate or for an individual borrower, Senator?
Well, in aggregate, it's about $51 billion. And the reason we estimate that is because that's what the Congressional Budget Office says is the amount of profit that the federal government currently earns on those loans that would be lost if the interest rate dropped on those loans down to the lower interest rates that we propose.
$51, $52 billion over 10 years.
Something like that. That's right. And for individual borrowers, that would mean we know for literally millions of borrowers, some number of hundreds of dollars a year. For some borrowers, it would be thousands of dollars a year. But everyone would have the chance to get into a fixed rate, lower interest rate mortgage.
So,
and that student loan, and that would be true.
God, feels like a mortgage, but it's
exactly,
student debt.
That would be true both for those who have public student loans, federal loans, and for those who have private student loans.
$52 billion over 10 years is nothing to sneeze at. You would pay for it by implementing a new tax on who, how much?
Well, we pay for it by putting in a minimum tax. We'd say we got to stitch up the loopholes enough so that people who are earning more than $1 million a year in adjusted income, that they would have to pay a minimum tax of about 30%, which, of course, is about what their secretaries pay. That's why this is often called the Buffett rule. You know, when Warren Buffett famously pointed out that billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries because of all the loopholes available. So this just says stitch up some of those loopholes and produce enough revenue from that to be able to cover the cost of reducing the interest rate on the student loans. But Tom, I want to make this point because I think it's really important to note. This is not so that we can subsidize student loans. Even at 3.86%, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the United States government will still make a profit on the student loans. It will just be much, much, much smaller than the profit is that it makes right now on, you know, 8% or 10% loans. So this is really about, you know, that basic question. Where are the taxpayers going to put their money? Is it in protecting loopholes for millionaires and billionaires, or put that money into bringing down the interest rates on student loans? One place or the other, I vote for the students.
Senator, I want to understand exactly this tax, the 30% minimum tax. Would that be then right on up to the very top of the income scale, no matter how high it goes?
Yep.
30% minimum.
That's right. That's right. You pay the same way that people who work for a living pay, you know, people who are secretaries and who have other jobs. It's saying that's the rate, that's the central rate, and we all pay at least that much if you make enough income.
So no matter what kind of write-offs or you name it are out there, to be very clear, I mean, we know lots of high-income people have lots of write-offs and pay far, far less than 30%. So this would be a big hike for a lot of well-off people.
For some well-off people, it would be a big hike. That's exactly right. Because it fundamentally says that all those loopholes that are available, really, let's face it, most of those loopholes are available only to rich people. You know, I don't know about you, but most people don't have a lot of money off in the Cayman Islands.
No, not too much.
You know, they can't take advantage of those loopholes. They're loopholes that were designed for those at the very top. And so this just says there is a minimum tax that they've got to pay, and the revenue from that will be used to offset the loss in profits that the United States government now makes on the student loan program.
I'm seeing estimates of $70 billion plus this would raise over 10 years. That's a lot. That kind of new tax revenue could go in a lot of directions. It'll take almost a revolution on Capitol Hill to make this happen. Of all the places you could put that extra money, that extra revenue, why toward reducing student loan interest rates?
Well, you know, I have to say part of the reason is because I think it is obscene that the United States government is making billions of dollars off the backs of people who just tried to get an education and who weren't fortunate enough to be born into families where, you know, daddy could write a check for the cost of college, but had to borrow money in order to get their educations. This is kind of a question about who it is you're trying to support, who it is you're trying to help take a step forward. Is it billionaires who've already made it? Or is it young people who are trying to get a start in life? Also, in this particular case, there's a profound impact on the economy overall. You know, we've already heard the alarm sounded from the Federal Reserve Bank, from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, from the Treasury Department. All of them have said that student loan debt is dragging down the whole economy. Young people can't buy homes, can't start small businesses, can't buy cars, can't take the economic steps that are both good for themselves individually, but good for this economy overall. So this is a way both to align our spending with our values and to get this economy moving more strongly in the right direction.
Senator Warren, Republicans all over the place are saying that both the president's announcement yesterday and your push for this further legislation are political stunts. Of course, there's a lot of opposition to raising those taxes on the wealthy. But beyond that, they say it's simply never going to happen. Slate says obviously doomed plan. And that it's just politics, positioning the Democratic Party, you know, vis-a-vis the Republicans for the midterms and beyond. Do you have a snowball's chance?
You know, I am really sorry to see the Republicans take such a political position on this, to say that it makes no difference what what it is that we need to do in this country. But their number one job is to protect the loopholes in the taxes that are available only for millionaires and billionaires. You know, let's keep in mind about this program that the 3.86% that we're talking about for undergraduate loans is a number that virtually every Republican in both the House and the Senate voted for just last summer as the right loan number for all new loans going out in 2013-2014. Now, I haven't heard a single Republican stand up and say why it is that people who borrowed a year earlier or 5 years earlier or 10 years earlier to do exactly the same thing, that is to finance an education, shouldn't have the same opportunity to refinance their loans down to the number that all of the Republicans voted for new loans just last year. This is a program that should have bipartisan support. We picked the number, 3.86%, because the Republicans had already supported it. Look, if it had been left up to me, I'd have gone for a lower interest rate. But this was an effort to say, all right, there was already common ground on what we need for young people. Pay for, if they don't like this pay for, then come up with another one. I haven't heard a single suggestion. Come up with some other way to pay for this bill. Come up with some other way to be able to offset the profits that are currently baked into the budget of the United States government from these student loans. If they come up with something else, we're willing to talk, we're willing to negotiate, we're willing to deal, but they can't just fold their arms and say, no, you can't do this.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, joining us from Washington. Senator Warren, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Her new memoir is A Fighting Chance. Kevin Carey, Elizabeth Baylor, let me come to you. Kevin Carey, you know, every politician describes their program as just obviously the best thing since sliced bread. What about this proposal? What about its fiscal impact? What about its impact on American university students and borrowers?
Well, a couple things. pardon me. I should note that it's not exactly true that the Congressional Budget Office says that the federal government is making huge profits on the student loan program. There are two ways to calculate, and this gets into some very kind of arcane fiscal issues, but there are two ways to calculate how much money the federal loan program costs. The Congressional Budget Office's preferred way, and they've said this, suggests that it costs the government money to run the student loan program.
Even at 8-point-something percent because of the giant default rate?
No, well, it is 3.88%, as Senator Warren said. You know, if you think about it, if it was wildly profitable to lend money to students at 3.86%, you would assume that banks would be falling all over themselves to do that. But in fact, no bank is out there doing that because these are loans where there's no credit check. You can't repossess someone's college degree.
Yeah.
That's why the federal loan program exists in the first place, to offer terms to borrowers that they couldn't get in the private market. The estimates, and so Congress has actually written a law that says to CBO, you have to estimate the cost of this program this way. And so they do that. But in fact, their preferred way doesn't suggest that there are huge profits to be made.
Does that mean that it would, in fact, by their preferred accounting method, cost more than $52 billion over the next 10 years?
Well, no, because we're just talking about changing the rate. So whatever, however much money you think it costs, it would cost 50-some billion more.
Okay.
The second point I would make is just, again, I think there is a lot of virtue in making student loans more affordable. I do think that the president's proposal is both less costly and more targeted toward people who are really, for a variety of reasons, in need. But none of this really gets at the principal on the loan. Right? Like it's all well and good if your interest rate is low, but if you owe a lot of money, you still owe a lot of money. And the price of higher education, for reasons we've discussed earlier, has been increasing at breakneck speed for the last three decades, even as the amount of money that regular middle-income American families have to pay for college hasn't increased. And it's debt is making up the difference. It's why we're having this discussion in the first place and why these numbers are so big.
I'm reading 1,200% increase over the last 30 years, way higher rate of increase than food, housing, cars, gasoline, TVs, even double the rate of medical care. We're looking at student loans, student debt. Elizabeth Baylor, if, as Kevin points out, you chop the interest rate way down here and still people are going to be looking at whatever big nut is at the heart of their borrowing, 70%, I'm reading now, 71% of those with bachelor's degrees had debt averaged $29,400. That means a lot have more than $29,000 debt. Does even a big step like this, which most political analysts in Washington say is not going to pass, even if it did, would that get to the heart of the problem, Elizabeth?
I don't think it would get to the heart of the problem, but it would get to the heart of one of the problems. I want to focus on the impact on the economy for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Refining student loans would allow borrowers and their families to have more money in their pocket each month. And CAP conducted an analysis of student loan borrowers, and we found that reducing the interest rate and reducing the monthly payments is really stimulative to the economy. When we talk about reacting to the economic recession of 2008, one of the things that Democrats talked a lot about was increasing the amount of money for folks who are unemployed. And one of the reasons is because we know that those people are going to go out and spend that money. And we think that allowing people who are carrying debt to pay less of that money means that they will go out and spend that money in the economy.
So you're making the argument that it's such a drag on the economy that this is almost stimulative behavior for the overall economy, not just for individual families or borrowers.
Absolutely. So one of the things that is interesting is that in reaction to the Great Recession, the number of young adults who are living in their own homes has declined. And one of the things that's very interesting is that every time somebody creates their own household, it generates $141,000 in economic activity. It means that that person goes out to Bed Bath & Beyond and they buy a new shower curtain, they buy new towels and new sheets and maybe some pots and pans and that kind of thing. And we think that, you know, not only should people have enough money in their bank accounts to hopefully one day go out and buy their own home, but for many people in this generation, we're talking about just having their own household.
But what about the sort of beast that's gobbling up all of this? I mean, I shouldn't say beast. It's an academic education, but it's very expensive now. And if you just make it cheaper to borrow or ding less of a graduate's income to repay money they've already borrowed, aren't we sort of enabling the price of college to continue to soar?
I'm not sure I would say enabling, but I definitely take your point that addressing this problem doesn't address the whole problem with respect to the rising cost of college. We absolutely think it's a problem. And in particular, we think it's important to look at where the money comes from for much of the institutions that students go to. More than 70% of students go to a public university or college, and I said earlier that public colleges have really disinvested the amount of money that they fund those institutions. And so the institutions have in turn begun to rely more heavily on tuition dollars instead of the public investment to fund their education.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about student loans, student debt, and the cost of college. We're looking at the president's call for change and more in this hour. Here was the president yesterday, said there's still a lot to be done to improve, bring down the cost of college for young people.
The good news is more young people are earning college degrees than ever before. That's something we should be proud of, and that's something we should celebrate. But more of them are graduating with debt. Despite everything we're doing, we're still seeing too big a debt load on too many young people.
I said cost. He said debt. There's a difference, and people are focused on it. In a Skype interview with the Wall Street Journal live yesterday, Republican Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander said the plan Senator Elizabeth Warren is proposing will not solve the student debt problem, focused on the wrong thing.
We Republicans think that college graduates don't need a $1 a day taxpayer subsidy to pay off their student loan. They need a job.
don't need a subsidy, need a job. The critique there of what the Republicans call the Obama economy. Elizabeth Baylor is with us this hour from the Center for American Progress in Washington. Kevin Carey from the New American Foundation. We heard from Senator Elizabeth Warren and looking to hear right now from you. Lots of callers lined up. Peggy in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for calling, Peggy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I feel too much time and energy is being put into fixing the symptom of the true problem here, which is the incredibly high cost of college. You had just said over the past 30 years it's gone up 1,200%.
Yeah.
That's totally ridiculous. I have three kids in college. My family has worked very hard, and we're making a lot of sacrifices.
Yeah.
So they don't graduate with a lot of debt. And therefore, I feel it's very unfair that anyone's loan should be forgiven. And all of this time and energy should be put into reducing the cost. How a college can justify what they're charging is just unbelievable. And why isn't anybody talking about that?
Where would you get out the knife, the cutting board, Peggy, on what you've seen in terms of college costs?
Well, for one thing, the dormitories that they live in are especially upscale, which isn't necessary. And do we really need 10 workout facilities on the college campus with all the high-tech equipment? I understand you do want to have some amenities to attract students to your college. And first and foremost, how much money is the administration making for running this college? I think all of that needs to be looked at.
Peggy, you and many others are really focused here. Kevin Carey, a couple of pieces to that. But let's go first, if I may, to the fairness issue. There's Peggy saying, look, we saved and scraped and worked hard to pay for our kids to go to college. And now what? The government's going to turn around and make it less expensive for others. And she sees a fairness issue there. What about that, Kevin?
I don't really see a fairness issue. I mean, to have your loans forgiven, we're talking about 20 years of loan payments, first of all, which is a long time. And second of all, definition...
That is pay no more than 10% for 20 years and it would go away. So it's not like you'd pay nothing.
Right. And you're talking about 20 years of not making very much money.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's good. So that's that seems like a lot of difficulty for someone to go through. And let's be clear, people are not entirely in control over the economic circumstances in which they find themselves. As mm-hmm. as people said earlier, you know, you were born in the wrong year. 22 years later, you might graduate into the teeth mm-hmm. of a recession.
Yeah.
So, you know, people investing in – people going to college is good for society. It's good to have people out there sort of making those investments in their own human capital. And it makes sense to have some element of social support and social insurance around it.
Elizabeth, what about Peggy's concern about college costs? She's grinding her teeth over that 1,200% rise over 30 years faster than anything else out there. And she sees fancy dorms and high-tech gyms and high administrative salaries at some of these universities and says, come on. Is anybody seriously talking about – we hear about the college cost bubble, Elizabeth, that it just may not be able to go on. Is somebody out there ready to prick it? Is it collapsing now somewhere? Do you see where this cost structure is coming down in a significant, widespread way?
I don't think I see the cost structure coming down, but I do see the cost continuing to rise. And I think that people – that. The action that President Obama took this week and that Senator Warren is calling for this week is happening because people are starting to have trouble paying for their college education.
Starting? I mean, people have had trouble for years now, haven't they?
Fine. Yes. But it's getting to a point where people feel like we need to make changes. And I agree that we definitely need to make changes in the student – in the cost of the programs. But we need to be cognizant of the fact that – part of the reason that people are paying more in tuition is because at other levels of our society, we are disinvesting from a public standpoint. And I think that one of the things that Center for American
You're talking there about public tuitions going up because states are pouring less into their public universities.
Yes, absolutely. So public colleges now rely more per student on tuition dollars, the money that the student brings in the door and oftentimes has to borrow for, than they are on investments from the state and from the public. And so what we want to do is reinvigorate this public investment in colleges that will mean that students don't that tuition prices don't continue to rise. But at the same time, what we need to ask from the universities is a dedicated conversation around what constitutes a needed increase in price and an increase in price because you're trying to get ahead of the school down the street or you want to attract some of the best students.
Yeah. Kevin Carey, a lot of people talk about exactly this point, what's being poured in at the state level in terms of public funds. But then there's also a lot of infrastructure out there that's gone in and salaries and all the rest. I mean, how much of the price rise do you see as public disinvestment, as Elizabeth puts it, and how much is a kind of gold plating that maybe we just can't afford as a country anymore?
A lot of the price rise over the last 5 years has at public universities has definitely been a function of state disinvestment. But keep in mind, you talked about a 30-year trend.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, those were 30 good years for the American economy. There was an awful lot of growth in GDP, an awful lot of increase in tax revenues, and tuition went up in all of those years also, even when state investment was increasing into higher education. It's absolutely true. There's way more spending on administrative salaries at colleges and universities than there used to be. There is an arms race among colleges for prestige, competing for students. These are organizations that are competing in a market and have a very advantaged position because, you know, they kind of have us all over a barrel. You can't avoid college. Everyone knows you have to have a college degree in order to even begin the kind of career that's going to support a middle-income family in America. And colleges have been taking advantage of their position in the market to charge more and more and more money over time.
You wonder how that lines up with our economy over time. Candace in Berea, Kentucky. Candace, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, you're on.
I'm calling because, first of all, I want to preface this by saying that I am in a particularly advantageous position because I go to Berea College, and I don't know if you all know about that, but our tuition is free here.
Wow. All right. That's a pretty good number.
Yeah. Free is better than any number, and that is what I am suggesting that needs to happen in the overall education system at large in this country. I mean, over and over again, we see the economic powers that be in the United States repeating the same mistakes of increasing the level of cost or growing certain levels of the economy or growing costs in different areas. And what we should be really looking at is not just reducing costs, but trying to find ways to match the similar education systems of our allies, like in Great Britain and in France. Or, I mean, and I understand they're smaller countries, but Finland, you know, places where they offer free education and put their citizens in an advantageous position once they finally have an education. And, you know, in the long run, I feel that it would equal out to more beneficial economic positions for the entire country at large.
Candace, you might be right. Other countries have made that calculation. You're sitting there tuition-free at Berea. Elizabeth Baylor, can you explain to us the economics of this? How do other developed countries send their students? And yes, they're smaller countries, but that means they're smaller economies, too. How do they send their young citizens to university, in some cases, for free, when we're loading ours with so much debt? How do they pull that off?
Well, there are two things going on. One is, in some countries like the United Kingdom, they have a very regimented education system, which means you take tests in high school when you're an adolescent, 14, 15, 16 years old, that qualify you to go to college.
What's that have to do with what you pay?
So they are only offering an education to the students who get admitted to the system. And so it's a system that doesn't allow open access for all people.
More exclusive. Okay.
Right. And so the other thing is taxes. They pay a higher level of taxes than we do in the United States, and they use that tax revenue to fund the education. But at the same time, in some countries, they're only educating the students who are coming out at the top. And the United States prides itself on the fact that we have a system that if you are a mother in your 20s or early 30s and you realize that you don't have the skills in this economy to help your family, you can go back to college at that point and you can persevere and you can get an education and you can and get a better job. And I think that's a very valuable thing in our country, and I think that we should not step away from it.
Kelly, I should
say, it costs money.
Yeah. Kevin, is anybody talking about that, deliberately doing that? Could it be that we'll get there in some other way, more revolutionary way, online education coming in and disrupting the old, campus and quad and ivy-covered walls and all the rest, and just giving us a much less expensive education, but we'll be sitting at home getting it on our computer screen?
Well, I don't think there's any question that a major technological disruption is on the horizon for American higher education. And it actually, I think it will be a lot more sophisticated than just people sitting at home. Now you have institutions like Harvard and MIT taking their undergraduate courses and making them available. These are high-quality courses available for free to anyone who wants to go on the internet and take them. I've taken them. I actually took an entire MIT undergraduate class right alongside students in Cambridge. I didn't pay a penny for it and got a certificate from MIT saying I had passed the class.
You're a genius.
So, it was a lot of hard work. I'm not a genius, and so it was tough. But that's the point in a way. You don't have to be a genius to learn a lot in higher education or to take really high quality classes. So that is definitely an element of it. I also think the time has come, frankly, for the federal government to take a stronger role in regulating the price of higher education. Not just subsidizing loans, but regulating the price. Right now, things have come to the point where the federal government disperses $150 billion a year, every year, in loans and grants to students who turn right around and hand it over to colleges and universities.
Yep.
And yet the federal government has no role at all, none, in controlling prices. And frankly, that's the kind of more ambitious proposal that it would be great to see the senior senator from Massachusetts, which is the historic heart of American higher education, really get behind.
What, you're saying government cost controls on university tuition?
Well, state governments regulate university tuition all the time. I mean, that historically has been the way that we keep prices down. That compact between state governments and the citizenry has been basically breaking down over the last 5 or 10 years. States are investing less money, and they're also letting public universities raise tuition. The federal government has come into the breach with loan money and grant money. And frankly, I think it now has to step up its role to really do something about prices, too.
Molly in Boston. Thank you for calling, Molly. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a comment. I am $250,000 in debt from federal loans. I have about $30,000 in private debt. Yes, I have 2 master's degrees, but I'm not making a ton of money at the moment, and I'm doing the income-based repayment program. And they're taking about, I pay about $120 a month, which is affordable, but I'm never able to save money. I worry about, am I ever going to be able to buy a house? What's my future going to look like? I kind of calculated it out. And if I'm paying $120 a month, it's going to take me 169 years to pay off my debt.
Molly, you may be in luck. I mean, this executive order says, I think after 20 years, they'll stop taking that payment. But what on earth were you thinking borrowing $250,000+ to go to college? How did you think you would deal with it?
My family was very skeptical, but I don't come from money. I wanted to be a psychologist. I was doing a doctorate program, a PsyD, which is different than PhD programs where they buy you. You have to actually pay in a PsyD program. And I actually stopped going partially because I've got burnt out from school, but also partially because of the cost. And, I figured I'm going to be a psychologist. I'm going to be able to pay off my loans one day. And I was kind of hopeful and, I guess, a little naive.
It's a hair-raising number. We wish you good luck with it. I appreciate your call. I mean, Elizabeth, the president's executive order for someone like Molly could be a real boon. I mean, $120 a month on $250,000 borrowing, that sounds like a heck of a deal. But then getting in that situation in the first place, what kind of system do we have running here, Elizabeth?
It's really tough. Recently, CAP conducted a survey of people who are now paying back their loans. And we're really concerned about the issue issues related to college choice and the choices people make and the debt that they take on when they make these choices. And so we surveyed we sent an email out to a lot of people, and we got 30,000 responses. And one of the things that I looked at was, we asked these people, what did you think about when you were borrowing your loans? And what do you think are the most important things now that you're paying your loans back? And we found that the higher amount of loans that people had, the less they thought about paying it back when they were making those choices.
I guess.
So we think that there really needs to be, and the Obama administration has been working on this, more and better communications to people when they're making their choices. And some of that is as simple as having a standardized shopping sheet that explains what is loans, what are grants, what doesn't need to be repaid, what needs to be repaid, and you compare your offers from multiple colleges on the same piece of paper. But we really think we need to counsel people about the importance of loan debt.
Boy, no kidding. And look at policy writ large. Kevin Carey, in 10 years, are we going to be having the same conversation, or are we approaching some kind of break here?
We'll be in the middle of the break 10 years from now, but we'll still have a lot of people owing a lot of money.
Well, things on the rails in Washington, more debate to come. People say Elizabeth Warren's plan won't pass, but there will be a lot more conversation about it in the days ahead. I hope you're a little better informed about the background to it after this conversation. Kevin Carey at the New America Foundation, thanks for helping us with exactly that. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Baylor at the Center for American Progress in Washington. Elizabeth, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Listeners, good luck to you. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.